Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 6, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Sad to say, this is not the show as originally broadcast. I left the CD with a recording of that show, what in the radio trade is known as an air check, a recording of what is getting sent out to the transmitter, in the Canal Street subway station, along with the CD containing the November 29th show. Collateral damage in that bit of carelessness was a jar of rather expensive shaving cream. The November 29th show is gone forever, but the December 6th show, this one, consisted mainly of two recorded interviews, so I'm patching those together, along with some of the music broadcast on that show, to produce this substitute version. The major loss would be my opening comments, but I have the script for that, so I'll read that in a moment. Obviously, some of the material is already obsolete, but that's what happens when you archive live radio. There are two guests on tonight's show. First, Peter Lavelle, a former academic and investment banker turned journalist who is now a commentator on Russian TV. And the second is Patrick Coburn, a correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent and author of the book The Occupation about the U.S. adventure in Iraq, which has just come out in paperback from Verso. Okay, first a rereading of the open commentary and then the interviews. Yes, it's housing again. This morning, it is December 6, the Mortgage Bankers Association released its delinquency and foreclosure survey for the third quarter of the year, and this was one for the record books. Nationally, 5.6% of all mortgages were delinquent, which means 30 days or more behind in payments. That's not quite a record. In 1985, the delinquency rate hit 6.1%, but that's when average mortgage interest rates were 13%, more than twice as high as they are now, and the unemployment rate was 7.3%, more than half again as high as it is now. In other words, we're now just a hair below a delinquency rate record that was set in a far more challenging economic environment than now. But here's the big underlying problem. Then the average house cost a bit over three times as much as the average household's income. Now it's over four times as much. The eye-popping stuff was a little below the headline delinquency number. For loans that are seriously past due, 60 to 90 days, the number was a record, 2.4%, far above the levels of the early 1980s, which were characterized by deep recession, high interest rates, and lingering high unemployment rates. And at the end of September, 1.7% of all mortgages were in foreclosure, also a record by a wide margin. Percentages are a bit abstract. Maybe numbers would be more clarifying. All in all, 2.5 million mortgages are delinquent. Since the average household is a bit over three people, that means that almost 8 million people are in some sort of mortgage distress. Almost 800,000 mortgages, representing about 2.5 million people, are in foreclosure. These numbers are almost certain to rise, especially if the economy weakens, which it looks like it's doing. Yes, these numbers are being driven by the subprime mortgages, but the problem numbers for prime mortgages are drifting higher as well. And more information is coming out about how even people with good credit were steered into subprime loans during the bubble. Brokers got higher commissions to encourage the practice because lenders got higher fees and interest rates, or thought they would have gotten. We'll see if they actually do. Today, the Bush administration unveiled its plan to help those in mortgage distress. No surprise, it's very narrowly drawn and doesn't require all that much of the lenders. The administration claims it will help 1 million people. That's small compared to the numbers I quoted earlier, and who can believe the administration anyway? More on all this in the coming weeks. Back after a musical break. That was an excerpt from Mission of Burma's Twice, twice spelled with a 2 instead of a T, from their excellent 2006 album, The Obliterati. I was a big fan of theirs back in the late 70s, early 80s, but I somehow missed their reunion. Well, I guess that's what happens when you try to keep up with things in your mid-50s. Okay, my first guest tonight is Peter Lavelle. Peter Lavelle started out as an academic, a historian specializing in Eastern Europe and Russia. He then spent some time as an investment banker in that part of the world, and then evolved again, this time into a journalist. He's now a commentator and host on Inside Russia TV based in Moscow. I wanted him to come on the show to give a fairer picture of the government of Vladimir Putin than what you get in the U.S. media, which often sounds like reheated Cold War rhetoric. The election we refer to in this interview is the parliamentary election, which provided a big margin of victory for Putin's party. Peter Lavelle.
The election this past weekend was denounced by Western governments. The American media is full of criticisms of it as a fraud and a sham and a manipulated affair. How much truth is there to this?
Well, all I can say is that they must have written all of their texts and prints and broadcasts, had it all done way in advance, because this was condemned long ago and they were just waiting to get their copy out. It's nonsense, Doug. I would not say that the election was perfect, but it was fair enough, and it was free enough. And the sentiment of the electorate was very, very clearly stated. We knew this from public opinion polls before the election, and I'd like to point out from independent public opinion polls. There's something called here the Yuri Levada Center that the Kremlin actually buys public opinion polls from. It actually commissions public opinion polls from these people. Why? Because there's no bias. What he predicted, that organization predicted, basically came true. So I really don't know what they're getting at. Now, there's a number of areas about media coverage of right before the election. Yeah, I would agree. It was a bit heavy-handed. Yep, I would. Was there intimidation? There might have been elements of that. But it's very difficult to intimidate millions and millions of people to vote without really some kind of reaction to it. Now, we all heard about this in media, but we didn't hear it from ourselves. It wasn't talked about. You have to remember, in Russian society, they're very skeptical of authority. They have a lot of reasons to. They have hundreds of years to be skeptical of authority. What you can hear on the street, what you hear from a taxi driver, is pretty much the sentiment. And you know what the sentiment was? Apathy. But one thing for sure, did Putin help us? Did he turn the country around? Yes. And that's what people did. They went and voted in a referendum for Vladimir Putin. Some people didn't like that. Some people call that undemocratic. I have no problem with that whatsoever. The sentiment of the population was expressed, and I think more or less played out in the election results. So it's really outrageous, in my opinion, living here for 10 years, that all of this was written about Russia's election.
Putin is genuinely popular. I don't think that is hard to dispute. What is the source of that popularity? I think a lot of people in the West don't really understand this. But give us the basics. Why is Putin approval rating that Jewish people should be jealous of?
Well, any Western leader would envy the genuine popularity that Vladimir Putin has, and it's very genuine. Let me just give you some numbers. The average monthly income in Russia in 1998 was about $68 a month. Today, it's over $500. That may not sound a lot to Americans, but the spending power, the purchasing power, is very immense. What it has happened under Putin in 8 years is the development of a middle class that is now confident, it knows its interests, and it's beginning to flex its muscles. I have always looked at it this way, is that Putin has brought them into being, but they're going to grow up, and they are growing up, and a lot of them will look at United Russia, the party of Putin, the party that did so well in the election, with an enormous amount of skepticism. Their attitude is basically they're not thanking this party. They're thanking the party for doing what Putin told the party to do, because they're like the cynicism towards the Duma, the lower house of parliament, it's almost just a parody. I mean, almost no one knows who's there, and they don't really care. They know there's a lot of millionaires there, and there's a lot of cronyism there, but they didn't get in the way of reform. They didn't get in the way of allowing businesses to be established. Didn't get in the way of people being able to express themselves. Civil society is here not exactly the same way it would be in the United States or France or Japan or anywhere else, but why should it be? I don't know why. But it's and foreign policy is very important, too. I think, you have to remind your viewers that everything that's written in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, it's immediately translated into Russian, and it's on the Internet. And access to the Internet has gone up amazingly so after 8 years. You know how many educated Russians that have decent jobs, that have good education, they read what the Weekly Standard says, and they say, that's not my country. And they actually support Putin even more. People that would be more or less skeptical. But see, Western media is actually turning away the people they're trying to attract. And I have seen a patriotic spirit. Some people are too far in the nationalism area, but a patriotic spirit here that you see people actually proud of their country. When the country almost completely fell apart less than 10 years ago, it's an amazing turnaround. So almost in every single sphere, a lot of young people that have, you know, they can make 3 times, 4 times, 100 times what their parents ever made. And they, again, attribute it to this person, this man. Now, no, Russians are not that naive. He's not the czar, and people don't look at him that way. He basically, the perception is he's been the foundation to keep the country moving and getting it developed. And when he made that speech in Munich, against the United U.S. foreign policy, I'll tell you, his public opinion polls went up 15% in almost a week and at already a high level. So, I mean, I think it's really multifaceted, and it really is also a rejection of a reaction to the humiliation that this country experienced in the 1980s under Western advice, telling Russians how to build a civil society, how to build political parties, how to have elections, how to build a market economy and all this. And you know what? It all blew up in their face. And a lot of Western advisors went back to Washington, D.C. with tons of money in their pocket. That's where all that aid went to. Bum advice. And that's why Putin, he knows, he can feel that pulse here. We don't want your advice. We want to engage you. We want to have businesses in your country, just like you have businesses in our country. I mean, every step of the way, it's very hard to refute the logic of Putin's foreign policy and domestic policy for the electorate. Again, he told them to vote for United Russia last Sunday, and they did. But they did it because he said so.
How much of the Russian recovery is a result of high oil prices? What would Russia look like this with $30 oil rather than $90 oil?
There's no doubt that oil has been very, very, oil and gas have been significant. There's been a turnaround in industry here. The services have built up. I would say right now the dependency on it is less than 50%. Before it was huge, amazingly so. And the government was extremely conservative in what it does now with oil revenues. It basically puts it in a stabilization fund, which that stabilization fund is being discriminated against in international markets. Russia wants to invest it globally. And they're saying, like the United States is very wary of this. It's very, very unfair. But at the same time, they've been able to pump it into developing infrastructure, which that job is far from over. You know, building of schools, getting computers to young kids, while investing in the regions, and it's slowly but surely happening. I wish it would happen more, and I wish the diversification would be faster. There's an element of complacency that has always worried me because of high energy prices. It very much worries me because you can put off till tomorrow, till the next week, the next month, and it's not wise. But overall, I think that it's been extremely helpful, but we're not experiencing Dutch disease here or anything like that. They've been very, very careful about that.
What is the base of Putin's, I'm talking about at the elite level, what is the base of his support? I mean, is there some sort of, like, people think he's kind of a KGB man and that's his base of support, that's where he emerges from, that's his people. Is there some sort of business or political elite around him? It sometimes sounds like a one-man hero story.
Well, no. What's very interesting is that I'll take the KGB story and I'll turn it upside down. Look, Russia, the Soviet Union collapsed. The new Russia comes into being. There was no real meaningful elite that could take over. Let's look at what happened in Eastern Europe in the late 80s, all the Velvet Revolutions. We had poets, and we had writers and teachers and authors, and they were the head of the Solidarity movement, you know, with intellectuals working with workers and all that. Russia had none of that here, really none of it. And you have to remember, and a lot of people don't know this, but by the end of the Soviet Union, the KGB was the least ideological part of the elite. They were very, very skeptical. They were the ones telling the Politburo, this thing is falling apart really fast. And so when the Soviet Union did fall apart, a lot of disgruntled people that saw how an the communist ideology and a command economy ruined the country were very, very skeptical in ever going back to anything like it. A lot of them actually accepted new principles of economics and politics. Believe it or not, it's actually true. They came to the conclusion, why don't we delimit where we have to get involved in society and still make the economy grow and make Russia a great country? And the civil, the level of tolerance for doing things in this country, it would marvel you if you would come here. I mean, there's really an enormous amount of personal freedom of what you can do. But to answer your question more directly, it's basically people that have more what's called here a sovereign democracy. You have to rebuild the state first for society to prosper. You have to rebuild the state first before Russia can actively and competitively engage the rest of the world. This is the kind of ideological mindset. Is it intensely democratic? No. Not at all. I wouldn't call Putin the world's first Democrat, but Putin certainly isn't against democracy. He wants to have the correct mix where, let's say for the example in the last election, they raised the threshold to 7% for a party to get into parliament. That's a pretty high bar, and the European average is 5%. Why? To discriminate against little liberal parties? No, not at all. Public opinion polls give them about 1 or 2%. I mean, there was no way they were going to even get 5%. But to build strong parties that appeal to the electorate all across the country. That way, you start creating a competitive party base. And they're a long, long way from that, but it's beginning to start. What drives the elite is the status quo. What they want is no more radical shakeups, no more big experiments. Look at Russia's foreign policy. For all the bluster, where does it have troops in the world? A few peacekeepers in Transnistria and in the South Ossetia and Abkhazia. That's about it. Russia is not actively engaged in any kind of conflict. Russia is extremely defensive in its foreign policy. Irrespective of what you read in Western media, Russia will not engage the United States in an arms race. It will not go one-on-one in anything in the military sphere because it knows it can't afford it. And at the end of the day, why would it do it? You know, if they're going to put anti-missile systems in Eastern Europe, Russia is going to stand up and say, no way, you're not going to keep moving your military hardware close to our borders when we're not doing anything to threaten you whatsoever. Any kind of movement like that, Russia will stand up and say no. After all, NATO promised it wouldn't expand, and it did. And Russia remembers that broken promise and remembers all of the promises that were made by the West and agreements during Yeltsin's time that weakened Russia. And again, you have this really strong reaction against that. And sometimes the bluster goes over the top. Sometimes I wonder, what's the point in raising the volume? But the attitude is that we're not going to get tricked by you people again. And there's a real strong bitterness, and it has seeped all the way through society, all the way through. They like American culture, they like American English, but they don't like the Pentagon, they don't like Congress, and they don't like George Bush.
There are a lot of Americans who might agree.
I'm speaking with Peter Lavelle, who is a Moscow-based analyst for Russia Today TV.
You said something earlier that I want to go back to and draw out a little more on it. You said the liberal parties have about 1%, 2% popularity.
Yeah.
Talk about people like Yavlinsky that are frequently quoted in the Western media as some sort of ideal. Do they have any base at all? And what about a character like Kasparov?
Grigory Yavlinsky is one of the kindest and one of the smartest people you could ever meet in your life. I mean, really wonderful, urbane gentleman. But he's completely out of touch. He's completely out of touch with what has happened in this country. For most of the electorate, he looks backwards. He's seen, rightly or wrongly, seen to be closely tied to Western ideologies, what was tried in the 1990s. And there's the perception that he talks at people and down to people. You get comments like, well, the Russians are still just Soviet people. And it's very quite demeaning at times. I mean, the intelligentsia in this part of the world has not had a good relationship with civil society because they think of themselves as different, above, and detached. And unfortunately, it continues. And I deplored that with Yavlinsky, please change your ways, because he gave me this great long lecture, and I said, Grigory, you could be elected governor of New York, but you wouldn't be elected dog catcher of Moscow with the way you talk. And this is the thing. There's another party called the Union of Rightist Forces. They're pretty much in the same boat. They're both Yabloko and SPS, the Union of Right Forces. They're tied to the past. They're tied to what failed in the 1990s. And they really haven't been able to change their tune very much. And on top of that, and it may not sound fair, it may sound undemocratic, but sometimes they come out with such strong criticisms of Putin, it turns off even moderate people here. They might say, you're right on a certain level, but look what the man did for the country. And that turns people off. Now, you mentioned Mr. Kasparov. I'm glad you asked me, Doug, because I think I've just lost any more energy to refute in the West what this man is all about. He's a national joke in Russia. I called him. I said, Mr. Kasparov, I would like to bring you onto one of my programs. I would like to interview you. You will have your say. You will be able to look at what we put on air before we put it on air. If you have some objections, we can talk about it. And he just returned with an expletive. Okay? That's all. And this is the kind of total rejectionist front that he gives to anyone that will really challenge him in Russia. And he said, Russian media won't talk to me. And I said, that's not true. You don't want to talk to them. You don't want to taint the perception of you in the West. And, you know, I'll give you a point. He just came out with a new book. Where did he go to the first signing of his new book? He went to New York. He doesn't care about his own people. He approaches Western media. I was at the same demonstration with him a few months ago. I saw him. He saw me. And all he did was talk to NBC, CBS, BBC, Sky News. He wouldn't talk to anybody else. His message was in English. I mean, he is just playing Western media for a fool, like Berezovsky does every single time. Every time Berezovsky said there's an attempt on his life, correlated to how close the Russians are going to be able to extradite him back to Russia. It's a cause and effect each time. He knows this Litvinenko affair, whoever was involved in it, was a gold mine for him. And this just really irks me, and I'll tell you, it irks people to no end in this country. Why do they listen to Kasparov and Berezovsky? What do they have to, how representative of the average person here? It would be like me going to Lyndon LaRouche and saying, Lyndon, what's going on in America? You're our main source of information about what's going on in America, and we're to tell all the Russian people that's what you think is the truth. It's the same equivalence. And Kasparov is also, you have to remember, when he marches the streets, and he does it, he legally gets a permit to either stage a rally or to march. He purposely breaks that and asks Western media to come to help him and show how the police are rough on him, arrest him. But the same demonstration I was at with Mr. Kasparov, he had his buddies, the National Bolsheviks. The National Bolsheviks. These people are stormtroopers, and their imagery is insulting. Their bigotry and their nationalism is horrifying. And Mr. Kasparov calls these people his friend because that's the only people that'll be his stormtroopers, and they attacked police. Yes, Doug, they went and attacked the police. Then they opened up their coats and had all this red stuff on them, whatever it was, and say, look, I've been attacked by the police. They were not. It was staged. I saw it with my own eyes. No, but CBS, NBC, CNN, everybody will show that and show just how brutal the Russian police are. They were pretty tough, but I saw the protesters come after them first.
We've only got a couple minutes left, so let's just conclude by asking, what's next for Putin? I saw a suggestion in Financial Times today that he might get the Duma to rewrite the Constitution so that he can serve a third term. Do you think there's anything to that, or what comes next?
Why would he do that if he could have done it before the parliamentary election and before the presidential election? There's no logic to me in that. He could have done that already. What I think he wants to do is that Russia doesn't have a concept of a lame duck. Putin wants to stay very much in control all the way up to the time he leaves office. And again, I'll say something that won't please Democrats, a Democrat with a small d, is that he wants to assure that his successor will continue his course. He will suggest one or two candidates in a matter of weeks, and one of the two will become the next president of Russia. So why he wants to continue in politics to manipulate things or be a czar and all that, I don't see why he would want to do that. He has an amazing legacy, the most popular, successful leader in modern Russian history. That's an amazing thing to take with you. Would he want to stay in some kind of position where his influence, personal opinion, would be felt? Maybe. This is a different type of political culture. I think the issue of political culture is so misunderstood in the West, because everybody has to be like the West or you have no culture at all. That's how I always see it, and it's really disturbing to people here. I don't know what his future is going to be, but I can tell you people don't want him to go away. He might just, you know, run the Olympic Committee for Sochi 2014, and that will still be a place of influence. Maybe becoming a chairman of Gazprom would be something like that. It will be something. He will be in the public eye, but he will not create a situation of dual power, being an individual outside of the power structures and then confront the person that he helped elect. He knows the Russian political elite already knows dual power doesn't bring stability. It just brings chaos. And I'll tell you, the political elite has no interest in that at all. They're very satisfied with the status quo, and so is the general population. Hence the election results last week that were more or less free and fair.
That was Peter Lavelle, a Moscow-based commentator on Inside Russia TV. Let's take another musical break. That was a bit of Man in Decline from Mission of Burma's 2006 album, The Obliterati. This is Doug Henwood, and this is a recreated version of Behind the News. My next guest is Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the British Daily The Independent and author of The Occupation, the story of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, just out in paperback from Verso. I thought that Coburn would be an excellent corrective to all the hype we've been hearing about the alleged success of The Surge. Patrick Coburn.
So suddenly everyone says the surge is working. At least that's the prevailing wisdom here in the United States. So what do you make of that claim?
Oh, I think it's completely exaggerated. It's easy to see why people say that, because there's been a dearth of good news from Iraq, really from the word go, from the overthrow of Saddam in 2003. So it's not surprising when there is some good news, particularly of those who supported the war to begin with, want to say we've won, we were right all along. There's also no doubt that casualties are down, but it's a very fragile situation, and it could easily go into reverse. I have a sense myself that it's rather like when there were big signs going up saying mission accomplished in 2003 before the war got going. This may be just a hiatus, not even the end of the war.
What do you attribute the decline in violence to?
There are a number of factors here. I mean, it is important that the Sunni community has turned on al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda was never very big, but it did launch these enormous suicide bombs. This was suicide drivers driving a vehicle packed with a ton or more of explosives and blowing themselves up in the middle of Shia marketplaces and religious processions. And it was these attacks, with hundreds of people killed and injured, that led to tit-for-tat killings of hundreds of Sunni in response. Now, I think we would have had a lot of violence anyway, but some of the mass slaughter we've seen last year and earlier this year stemmed from these big bombs, and we're not having them at the moment.
Do you have any sense what al-Qaeda was trying to accomplish by these? They look like the very definition of senseless violence.
Well, you know, to al-Qaeda, a Shia is a Muslim heretic who's just as worthy of death, if not more so, than an American Marine. So they were attacking the Shia for that reason. Also, under Saddam, Iraq was really a Sunni run country and had been really for hundreds of years before Saddam. So the Shia, who are the majority, 60% of the 27 million Iraqis, were coming to power, and Al-Qaeda and quite a lot of the Sunni community wanted to stop that.
Now, what about the increase in U.S. troops? Did that have what was the contribution of that to the pacification of Baghdad?
It had an effect in Baghdad, but again, it's exaggerated. Last year in Baghdad, we had really a battle for the city between the Sunni and the Shia, and the Shia largely won it. One of the reasons we're not having so much violence now is that there was a winner and a loser last year. Probably about three-quarters of Baghdad is Shia-controlled and Shia-occupied at the moment, maybe even higher. There aren't many mixed areas left. In a lot of areas, there aren't too many people of the opposing community left to kill. So this was an important reason that violence went down. And at the same time, the Mahdi army, the main Shia militia, has been stood down, is on a six-month truce at the moment. That, again, is reducing the level of violence.
What's behind that truce, and will it last?
Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Sadrist movement, which includes the Mahdi army, always said that the sectarian killings being carried out by the militiamen were not at his orders. There were rogue elements there. And there's probably, I'm not sure that's 100% true, that he wasn't didn't have any control of these elements, but certainly he was unhappy that he was seemed to be dragged along by militia army, which he didn't really control. He also has wanted to avoid an all-out confrontation either with the government or with the American army. He went through that in Najaf in 2004, fought two battles then. He's always been disinclined to try that again. He wants to keep strength on the ground, but not go for a direct military confrontation.
The civilian casualties have declined. What about attacks on U.S. forces? Have those come down as well?
Well, they've gone down, too. In a lot of areas, in Anbar, in Amaria, in various very tough Sunni neighborhoods, the Sunni militias who have been armed by the U.S. forces and are paid by them have taken over. So we really have another piece on the board, which is a Sunni militia. Now, obviously, from the U.S. military point of view, this is good news, because these were guys who used to be shooting at Americans and now sort of be apparently under American control. But nobody knows if that is really true. You know, it's a rather bizarre situation that these people who, for 4 years, the U.S. was denouncing as killers from Saddam's regime, former members of the Mukhabarat, that's the secret police, military intelligence officers, people with blood and American blood on their hands, are suddenly the new American ally there, and are called concerned citizens. But actually, a lot of that propaganda was true. A lot of these are former Ba'athist military intelligence people. They just happen to have changed sides at the moment, and they might well change sides again.
What are their motives? What do you suppose their intentions are?
One reason was the battle for Baghdad last year, which the Shia won, and these people are mostly Sunni. So I think that they couldn't see what was the point of them trying to drive the Americans out when they themselves were being driven out by the Iraqi Shia. I think that was one major reason. Secondly, Al-Qaeda was attacking them, had overplayed its hands. Last year it declared the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, whereby it sort of Al-Qaeda tried to set up areas where it was in total control. So it was, for instance, demanding that every family contribute one of its sons to fight with the Al-Qaeda forces. Again, Sunni have said to me, you know, that they're really frightened by this, by one of their sons being taken off and are probably thrown into combat and killed. Secondly, the Al-Qaeda was shooting people who it said worked for the government, but these were people who, you know, collected the garbage, who had tiny jobs, maybe, you know, as a guard on some dam or roadworks or something like that, people who are just earning a few dollars for their families and had no real connection with the government. This again caused outrage in the Sunni community. And that's why we had the backlash.
Where did these all mostly foreigners, these Al-Qaeda?
No, mostly Iraqis. There's always been a minority of foreigners there. So it's very difficult for foreigners to operate in Iraq. It's such a unique culture. It's difficult for anybody to come outside the country and be accepted. So initially you had some foreigners, Zarqawi and others, who was a Jordanian, coming in. But more recently you've had really just Iraqis running it. The suicide bombers tend to be foreigners, but that's really the only element which comes where the foreigners are dominant.
A lot of people in the anti-war movement frequently speak of the Iraqi resistance. Is there such a unitary thing? Can you use one name for them?
I don't think so. I mean, at one level, if you look at, you know, are Iraqis opposed to the occupation, you bet they are, because, you know, one knows this from talking to them. And secondly, every opinion poll I've seen, and the opinion polls are pretty accurate there now, a lot are being taken, show that a great majority of the Sunni and a majority of the Shia these days are wholly opposed to the occupation, and a majority are in favor of armed attacks on the coalition. But in fact, the U.S. is pretty well the only member of the coalition these days. And this is true of the Sunni from the beginning, but for the Shia, it's been going up and up. So you have a general opposition to the occupation. But there's never been a single resistance, obviously, combining Sunni and Shia. And within the Sunni community, there were always lots of different groups. Probably somewhere there were people who linked together those groups that were outside al-Qaeda. But there was never a sort of high command, a chief of staff, and a sort of a way in which an order was given at the top and was immediately obeyed at the bottom.
What's been happening in the south as the British withdraw their forces?
It's really been taken over by the militias. In fact, it's been taken over before the British withdrew. So you have three different militias fighting for control of Basra. But the violence went down there. I mean, most of the violence was against the British just before they left, and the British are in the airport now, but they aren't doing anything. They're not sending out patrols, so it's a very passive presence, and I think it's only really maintained because London doesn't want to annoy Washington too much by depriving it of its sole remaining ally.
I'm speaking with Patrick Coburn, who is a Middle Eastern correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent and author of the book The Occupation, just out in paperback from Verso.
What do you think is going to happen as the U.S. Removes some of the forces, as reverses the surge?
I think that, you know, the problem in Iraq, that none of the conflicts which burst into the open with the overthrow of Saddam Hussein have been resolved. The conflict between Iraqis and the foreign occupiers, the Americans, has not been solved. The conflict between Sunni and Shia Arabs have not been solved. The conflicts within these communities, within the Sunni and within the Shia, not been solved. That fighting has been getting worse. And there's yet another conflict between the Arabs and the Kurds. So none of these things have been fought to a finish yet. And that's why overall I'm fairly pessimistic about the prospects over the next year or two. But having said that, it's very difficult to put a time frame of when these different conflicts will come to a head and when they'll explode into actual violence or when that violence will increase.
Let's talk about some of Iraq's neighbors. First of all, what's going on with Turkey and the Kurds? How do you read that?
I was up on the border a few weeks ago, and the Turks are making these continual threats saying we're going to come across, that you must do something about the PKK. That's the Turkish Kurd guerrillas. But at the end of the day, the Turkish government doesn't really want to invade northern Iraq because they've done it. They've done it 24 times before under Saddam. They never got them anywhere. These are enormous mountains, very easy for guerrilla forces to conceal themselves. The Turkish government doesn't want to strengthen the Turkish army. The Slovenian government's just won the election. If the Turkish Kurd guerrillas launch some attacks in which, let's say, 30, 40 Turkish soldiers were killed, then I think the Turkish government would have to do something. Send troops across, launch bombing raids. The force of public opinion would be too great. But I think it doesn't want to get involved in a war in northern Iraq with the Kurds.
And then Iran, for a while the U.S. was really blaming Iran for a lot of the problems, a lot of claims about shipping in fighters and weapons. They seem to have pulled back on those claims. What is Iran's role in Iraq now?
Well, you know, Iran has had a role in Iraq, or the area of Iraq, for the last 5,000 years, and it'll go on having that role. The idea that, you know, from the very beginning, from the overthrow of Saddam, indeed from the first Gulf War, but way back in 1991, the U.S. had this problem that if you got rid of Saddam Hussein, then the winners were going to be the Shia community in Iraq, because they were the majority, and if you had an election, they would win it. And the Iranians, who were also Shia, who were linked to them, and whose great enemy was Saddam. Ever since, the U.S. has been trying to somehow replace Saddam with a regime which isn't run by Shia religious parties and influenced by Iran. I doubt if it can be done. It couldn't happen. Nobody's been able to do it the last 4 years. I doubt they'll be able to do it in the next 4 years.
And what's happening with in the political realm? Is there any progress in an effort to create some kind of coherent state, coherent government?
There are efforts there, but I mean, we come to this question that none of the differences are really resolved. How much power should people have? You know, the problem is anything you do in Iraq has pluses and minuses. Just at the moment, you know, the administration in Washington is jubilant that violence is down, and it's created this very large force of Sunni militiamen, 77,000, and which is paid for by the U.S. But you know, a year ago, but previously, the U.S. was against more militias on the grounds they made the Iraqi government weaker. And this militia force does not answer to the Iraqi government. So you have one more piece on the chessboard. You have power more fragmented. So in a sense, although al-Qaeda has been losing out, although there's less violence in various Sunni areas of Iraq, the Iraqi government is no stronger and in some ways is weaker.
What do you think the U.S.'s long-term intentions are in Iraq? Do they intend to stay there forever?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's very dangerous, this thing of saying we're going to have 50,000 troops for, you know, in this area for the next decade or 2 decades. But if that's true, then there's going to be continual war. I mean, for obvious reasons that people generally object to occupiers. And they particularly object to the U.S. occupying them. So I think that an attempt to have bases in Iraq will just prolong the war. At the end of the day, the U.S. presence in Iraq has really, from within weeks of the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, been deeply unpopular among Iraqis, with the exception of the Kurds, who are rely somewhat on the U.S. But otherwise, it's very unpopular, both among the Sunni and the Shia. So I think so long as you have American troops there, you will have resistance to it, and that resistance is likely to be violent.
Which suggests that it's not likely that the U.S. could find some sort of clients who could do their work for them, Iraqi clients who could do their work for them.
Well, you can always find clients, but you know, can they do it? The U.S. has a long tradition in Iraq since 2003 of recruiting clients who don't really bring very much to the table, that their main strength is that they have good relations with the U.S. So I don't think that it's very likely that you will have a stable client state. You can have clients running the government, but then they can only stay in business if they're supported by American troops. You can have other people running the government who are less reliant on the U.S., but they're not going to be your clients.
it seems that the U.S. is in a bit of a box, just, you know, that old cliche about losing imperial credibility if the U.S. withdraws. But if the U.S. stays, it seems like an insupportable situation over the longer term. Is there any way out of this dilemma?
Yeah, I think there is, but it, and I think it's been there for quite a long time, that there has to be, one, an agreement talks, and then an agreement with Iran. One of the peculiar things about the present situation is that the Iraqi government is supported strongly by, in two places. One is Washington, which is trying to build up the government. The other is in Tehran, the Iranians, because this is a Shia government, it's a Kurdish government. These are people running the government, are close to the, a lot of them spent a lot of their lives in Iran. It's the other, the Sunni and the other Arab states, who much dislike this government. But it is one of the peculiarities of Washington's policy is to somehow to try and prevent this Shia government having good relations with Iran. But if there were negotiations, successful negotiations with Iran, then, and the other powers, then I think that that would, we would progress towards having sort of serious long-term resolution of problems within Iraq. Again, there has to be an acceptance that the Shia are the majority that are basically going to hold power, which means that the U.S. can't keep going after the Mehdi army, which is the main militia there, and backing another Shia militia against them. One can always play these political games in Iraq, but I doubt if they get you anywhere at the end of the day.
And finally, what do you make of the sudden revelation that, well, maybe Iran wasn't working on nuclear weapons after all?
Well, it's sort of, you know, it's very, very interesting. It's interesting that that's what they say they know. It's interesting that it's also come out so strongly. I mean, I have the feeling that if they'd made exactly the same finding a few years ago, then the White House would have had the strength to suppress it, to make sure it wasn't published, to produce other reports, to blur the impact of the report. So I think that that shows the opposition to a war with Iran from the U.S. intelligence agencies and also from the U.S. armed forces, and also shows the weaknesses of the White House. But I doubt very much if it would have appeared, and certainly appeared in this form, 3 years ago.
And that was Patrick Coburn, Middle Eastern correspondent for The Independent and author of The Occupation, just out in paperback from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood, and this recreated version of Behind the News. Let's go out with this from Mission of Burma's classic song, That's When I Reach for My Revolver. When Moby did a cover of this song some years ago, he changed the lyrics to That's When I Think It Is Over. When asked why, Moby responded that he did not want to promote gun violence. Stick with running your tea shop, Moby. Bye.
Father.